MacCast, Sunday, November 19th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you after a week off, an unplanned week off, because I got incredibly sick last week on Friday. I just got slammed with this massive cold, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but I'm still kind of recovering from it. You may even be able to still hear it in my voice a little bit. And I know it's been going around. I've talked to a few other people. Actually, my friend David Sparks, we're supposed to have breakfast tomorrow morning, and he had to call and cancel because he's been hit by this thing. So it's particularly nasty going around. I guess that means it's the start of winter. We're getting into the winter season. Got Thanksgiving coming up this week. You may be traveling. Maybe you're already at Thanksgiving if you're in the States. Happy Thanksgiving for those of you outside the States. I guess Canada, you had your Thanksgiving, last month in October. And I don't know where else it's celebrated. But if you're having Thanksgiving, happy Thanksgiving. We got a lot of really cool stuff to talk about in this episode of the MacCast. We're going to be getting into iPhone 10 stuff and what's happening maybe with the next iPhone 10. We're going to talk about Face ID hacks that maybe aren't really hacks, Animoji, and some confusion over how that technology works. We'll try and clean that stuff a little bit, clarify that a little bit. Wow, I'm having trouble talking today. Some iOS updates to talk about, Mac Pros or iMac Pros and what might be in that. That's coming still later this week, and some more information about the HomePod. And not great news, but we'll get into it and let you know what's going on there. We have all of that, and of course, some great feedback from you on the iPhone X. We're going to get into Siri and finding applications or using Siri as an app launcher and some troubles that you might be having there with the latest iOS update and questions about, do I buy an iMac or an iMac Pro? And that should round out the show. So I want to dive into that stuff in a minute. But first off, I have a pretty big announcement for you here at the top of the show, a little business to take care of. I have been lucky enough to be doing the MacCast for, it's almost 14 years now. The anniversary is actually December 13th, 2004. I released the very first MacCast. And I've also been one of those people who I've been lucky enough for part of that time to be doing this show as a semi-part-time job. A good part of my income actually comes from the advertising you hear here on the MacCast, and I am grateful for that. It's been made possible by you, the supporters of the MacCast, those of you who are MacCast members, and also the sponsors, and for that, I am forever grateful. I'm also very grateful that I've been able to remain independent. I am the sole person in charge of this show. I do all of the show prep, all of the hosting, the production, the business management, the day-to-day stuff. That is all me. I'm lucky enough to work with an awesome group of people over at Backbeat Media. They handle the ads. You've probably heard me talk about that at the end of each episode. And they do that part, but the rest of it really is all me. And I'm happy to be able to do that and lucky to be able to do that. A lot of people are in larger networks and things like that. But consequently, that also means that, when things get busy or when stuff happens, it's just on me. So, podcasting is growing up. There's been a lot of changes in our industry recently. We've had hit podcasts like Serial, and there's celebrities now doing podcasts, and more major networks are getting in on the action. And all of that means that podcasting is also changing a little bit. And it's getting a little bit harder for us indies to stay noticed and get audience and get recognized, especially by advertisers in this new, bigger ocean. So while these podcasts have brought great awareness and new listeners, and we've seen some growth there, there's also some challenges popping up. And, I've always taken great pride in the fact that the MacCast is an awesome community. And something I've often wanted to do is do more to grow and better serve our community. But again, being indie and on my own, that's a little bit challenging. So what's happening today is I am asking for your support. Your support in a number of ways to help me try to do a number of things. One of those is just cover the basic costs of running the MacCast here day to day. And also just hit some goals of maybe trying to expand into more content, creating more opportunities for me to interact with the community and interact with you on various levels, both virtually and in person, and maybe even try and have something like a MacCast community conference. That's something I've been wanting to do for a long time. But of course, all of that takes resources, and one of those resources specifically is money. So what I'm announcing today is a new MacCast Patreon. I'm going to give you a couple things you can do to help support the MacCast, and the Patreon is going to be one of the most direct ways. So if you want to give direct support, you can check out patreon.com/MacCast. And what I've done is I've set up some really cool goals for us to reach and also some rewards, some things for you to help potentially grow and expand the MacCast beyond what it's been for the past 14 years. And I realize that maybe not everybody can give, but it doesn't take very much. As a matter of fact, if everyone who downloads this podcast each week just gave 15 cents a month, just 15 cents a month, we'd actually hit every goal that I've laid out in the current Patreon campaign, and we'd expand it to more awesome goals. So check out what's over there, patreon.com/MacCast. If you can give a buck a month, a couple bucks a month, that would be greatly appreciated, and it would go a long way toward covering the costs of the MacCast on a day-to-day, that things like hosting and servers and equipment and gear that I need to keep the show running. Potentially, if we hit some of our goals, it'll allow me to cover the costs of some of the Apple products that I get and talk about and review and start to get out to more trade shows and into the community and stuff like that. So that is a great way to directly support the MacCast. And I know there's many of you already out there supporting the MacCast. I've already talked to the MacCast members on the last MacCast member episode about what's going on here. And I certainly appreciate all that support, all of that support. And of course, if you're unable to give, not a big deal. The MacCast is going to stay free. I'm not really changing anything on that side of thing. This is really just about being able to expand what we are currently doing. And I'm going to try the Patreon for doing that. I know a lot of people do that. I know a lot of people are giving money in a lot of different places. So don't feel bad if you can't give. But if you can, just spare even just a little bit, you know, a buck a month, that's 25 cents an episode. That would go a long, long way. And like I said, the key is here, if the entire community chips in just a little bit, it's going to be amazing. We're going to be able to do some amazing things, maybe even bring on some people to help me out so I can expand things. Who knows, but I'm going to be updating you through the Patreon if you subscribe and doing all sorts of things there. So if you can't do that, there are a number of other ways you can support the show. A big, huge one is just to do a review in iTunes. Whether you do a star rating or you actually write a review, that really helps. It helps in a number of ways. It helps improve our ranking on iTunes, which also helps improve our visibility to potential sponsors who might come on and support the show. So a lot of these things are going to be ways that you can help support me in getting more sponsorships and things like that. Again, in this new kind of dynamic where there's a lot more competition for those spots. So another thing you can do is use the sponsor URLs. If I have a sponsor on the show, if you can support them because they support us, that is a great way to give back. You don't have to buy everything, but if you click on the URL or go to the URL, even just that helps. So if you can do that, I would really appreciate it. Of course, follow me on social media because sponsors look at those numbers when deciding who they may want to support. So the number of followers I have on Twitter makes a big difference. So if you're not already following me on Twitter or you're not subscribed to the MacCast Facebook page, something like that, if you want to take the time to do that and participate there, that is greatly appreciated. And of course, tell your friends and family to listen. If we can grow the audience, that helps as well. And so share the show with your friends and family on social media, through email, however you might want to do it. Tell them about it. Get them to subscribe. And that is a huge help as well. So that's what I wanted to talk to you about at the top. Patreon.com/MacCast if you want to support us there. And last but not least, just a huge, massive thank you to you for downloading the podcast, for any support that you've already given, either by listening, by being a member, by supporting the sponsors, by sending in your emails and audio comments every week. That's a huge way to support the show. And just generally being the best audience in the Apple Mac community. And I really mean that. I talk to other podcasters and they don't get nearly the support and feedback that you give me. So that is incredibly appreciated. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. So that's our little bit of business that we have to do. Now let's just jump into the news. Bigger, better iPhone X possibly coming. I've had a number of you say that you love the iPhone X, but a few of you comment, and we'll hear from some of you a little bit later, a few of you have commented and said, hey, it's great, but to me, I'm coming from having an iPhone 7 Plus or maybe a 6S Plus. It does feel like a little bit of a downgrade in the screen size. And believe me, I totally get that because of the perception. But what's really interesting, and I just wanted to point out, is that the iPhone X actually has more pixels on it. It's 2436 by 1125 pixels in terms of resolution versus the iPhone Plus, the 7 Plus, or the 8 Plus, for example, that's 1920 by 1080. It's also, the iPhone X, taller but not wider, and it's really that width that I think people who are saying it feels like a little bit of a downgrade are responding to. If you look at the physical dimensions of just the screen portion, the iPhone X is 2.46 inches wide by 5.32 inches tall. That's versus 2.69 inches wide, so just a little bit wider, about a quarter of an inch wider, right? 0.2 and change wider on the plus size iPhones versus 4.79 inches tall. And what that really means is that when you're watching video, say, for example, on an iPhone X, the safe area, if you cut out the notch, is about the same height as it would be on an iPhone 8 Plus. And so to me, the video image is likely, and I haven't done the exact measurements, but it's likely almost exactly the same physical size on an iPhone X as it would be on an iPhone 8 Plus, because what happens on the iPhone X is you get the little pillboxing, so you get the black bars on the left and right, but it goes edge to edge in that narrower screen, versus on an 8 Plus, you're generally going to get a letterboxed video and not the extra video on the side. Now, if you zoom in on both models, then, you know, that's a little bit different, but then you're losing part of your video image. So even though it feels like a downgrade, I think if you actually looked at pixel per pixel and at the actual size of the image, the iPhone X is probably giving you about the same size image and you have a smaller physical form factor because of the edge-to-edge display. But, you know, I know still physically everything on the iPhone 8 Plus or the iPhone 7 Plus is just going to be bigger, right? Because it's less resolution. And so everything's going to feel bigger. And for us older folks, that does make a difference. So I totally get people saying, hey, this feels like a downgrade. But that brings us to the news for this week, which is good news for you because Ming-Chi Kuo has told his investors that he believes that Apple will be making a larger OLED version of the iPhone next year, a 6.5 inch OLED version of the iPhone due out sometime in 2018, likely in the regular release cycle. So September, October timeframe we're looking at, unless they stick with kind of the later into November thing that happened with the iPhone X. But I think they're going to push it back to that October release, September announcement, that sort of thing. And he does say there's going to actually be a couple of different models. Of course, an updated version of the 5.8 inch display of the iPhone X. Who knows if Apple's going to stick with the 10 name or if they're going to call it iPhone 11. Don't really know. And he also says that Apple will be adding a 6.1 inch version of the Plus model. So there will be a Plus version, so I guess an iPhone X Plus, but also a replacement for the current Plus model that would retain the TFT LCD screen and be priced more in the mid-range, so $649 to $749 to hit that part of the market. So that'll kind of round out the lineup. So you'll have two higher-end OLED versions, the 5.8-inch model and the 6.5-inch model, and then you will have a larger-sized TFT screen. And I think Apple's going with the larger versions of the phone across the board because their sales numbers seem to be playing out and showing that the iPhone X and the iPhone 8 Plus models are far outselling, for example, the iPhone 8 model. So it makes sense that in 2018, they're probably going to go with those three sizes in the lineup. Ming-Chi Kuo also does seem to indicate that all three models would get Apple's true depth camera system. And I should have pointed out that that update to the Plus model, the 6.1 inch, it's going to be the same size. They're going with an edge-to-edge display there as well, even though it is going to be a TFT LCD display and not an OLED display, again, to keep the cost down. But does look like Apple's going to have true depth across the line, and that's going to be it for 2018 updates. There are, of course, processor updates and your standard GPU updates, but there's not going to be a lot of big changes to the iPhone, and there's not going to be the 3D true depth camera system coming to the iSight camera, at least not in 2018. Kuo has been looking at even further out into what Apple is developing, and he does expect them to develop a 3D depth system for the iSight camera in 2019. But the big difference, he's saying, is they're going to use a different technology. They're going to use lasers and a time of flight algorithm rather than the IR dot projector system. And that is because he's saying the iSight system is going to be more focused on augmented reality. So the idea that the time of flight system could give you depth to try and figure out where virtual objects might be on the screen so they could be positioned more accurately and in a more realistic way when they're set into a scene. So, for example, a big problem with AR right now is you drop an object, and if somebody walks what presumably in the depth of field would be behind it, they, of course, actually end up in front of that augmented reality image. With this system, you'd be able to predict that and then slice out and potentially move that person into the right place within the frame. So should be pretty cool, but that's not supposed to be coming until 2019. Now, a few other odds and ends. If you have an iPhone X right now, there have been a few reports of some people having issues. They seem isolated. So I think these are within normal range of just, hey, when you're making millions and millions of iPhones, occasionally things slip through the quality control. But I want to point these out in case you've run into them with your own device. You might want to go in and take it into Apple and have it looked at. It's just more of, hey, if you're having these problems, you're not alone. Some other people are having these issues as well. One of them is a crackling or a buzzing sound coming from the front-facing earpiece speaker, especially at high or maximum volumes. Now, one thing about this is if you've noticed and you have an iPhone X, the speakers can get a lot louder. Apple says they're 25% louder, but I have to tell you, I've played mine and I cannot crank them all the way up. It's just way too loud. And I think you're getting a little bit of distortion. So I don't know if this is just distortion with certain songs or tracks or things like that when it's at a really high level, or if there's actually really a problem with the speaker system. But if you are getting that crackling or buzzing again, you might want to have Apple check it out. Another kind of more serious one, in my opinion, is some people are reporting getting green lines forming along the left-hand side or right-hand side of their OLED display. And there have been a few isolated reports of a green line showing up somewhere else in the LCD or in the OLED display. I guess Samsung phones have suffered from this in the past, and because Apple does use Samsung OLED panels, it may just be, again, one of these little defects that occasionally shows up. Apple does seem to be replacing affected units with the green line issue, so if, unfortunately, your iPhone X has ended up like that, again, contact Apple, and maybe they can get you a replacement, hopefully pretty quickly. And then the last thing that we're hearing about is a couple little problems with the display in terms of the lamination between the layers. Some people are reporting getting air bubbles that they can actually push out for a second. And that does seem to be the layers of the OLED display maybe separating a little bit. Maybe that glue didn't stick quite as good as it should. And that's an issue. And also some people are reporting some problems with the oleophobic coating rubbing off in certain areas of the screen. And that may just be, you know, a quick application. Again, Apple's trying to produce these things as quickly as possible. And I think sometimes the rushing things out, a few things get through quality control. But like I said, these things seem to be pretty isolated. So I don't think they're affecting a large range of people. But if you are impacted, just be aware you're not alone. And then rumors of potential updated iPads. What's going to happen with the iPads in 2018? Well, I think some of these things are going to be pretty obvious. Apple removing the home button, going with true depth cameras and Face ID on future iPads, and also edge-to-edge displays. So I don't know if that means the iPads are going to get a little bit smaller in terms of the form factor, or we're just going to get larger displays. I'm guessing that it's going to be the latter. Now, they are saying these are still going to be LCD panels and not OLED panels, because larger OLED panels would significantly, I think, drive up the cost. And, of course, the new iPads will also have faster processors, and they're saying potentially custom-designed Apple GPUs. And then the report does come from Bloomberg, and they say that Apple is working on a new version of the Apple Pencil to come out along with the new iPad in 2018, along with new software tools for using the stylus. So it sounds like the Apple Pencil is going to get a little more software tricks up its sleeve in 2018, and they are expecting the release of updated iPad Pros to happen sometime around September of 2018. So we're going to have to wait again until the fall to see these updates, but that's a little bit of what we can expect from Apple probably looking into 2018. Let's talk a little bit about Face ID hacks and Face ID hacking, or probably what we should more accurately term Face ID spoofing. There were a couple of stories that showed up over the last couple of weeks that are trying to spread, I'm just going to come right out and call it FUD, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the accuracy or security of Face ID. And we've talked about this. We talked about this, I think, a little bit in the last episode of the MacCast, where we had a couple twins who, or actually it was siblings, a brother, a pair of brothers, one younger, and they showed that the younger brother could open the other brother's iPhone 10 using Face ID, and I talked about the reasons behind that. Following that, we have now seen the what I'm going to call the Vietnamese creepy mask. There's a Vietnamese security company. They made a mask out of a 3D printed frame, a silicone nose that was developed with the help of a forensic artist, and also a couple of 2D images for the eyes. And if you've seen the pictures of this thing, it is hideous, man. It is super scary. We talked a little bit about it on the iOS show. But they were able to prove that they could get this face mask to unlock an iPhone using Face ID. And this was something that Apple said they worked with, you know, Hollywood mask makers to make sure that you wouldn't be able to do it with a face mask. But there were a lot of caveats that really didn't come out in a lot of the news reports that I wanted to point out that explain sort of how this hack worked or how this spoof worked and why we really don't have to probably be worried about it. First of all, it worked only after a number of attempts and a lot of tweaking to the point where if you had really been trying to produce one of these masks and unlock somebody's phone with it, it probably would have fallen back on the passcode and you would have been locked out, right? You only get a certain number of attempts with the face. You can't continually tweak it. And these guys were tweaking it quite a bit. In fact, in a demo that was given to Reuters, they were able to prove that this mask worked for unlocking a phone, also along with the face of the researcher who it was based upon. But when Reuters asked them if they could recreate the test by registering a phone, so like removing the Face ID and re-registering a face and then using the mask, the researcher declined to do that. And the reason he declined is he said that the iPhone and the mask need to be placed at very specific angles and that the mask would need to be refined in order for it to work. And he said that entire process could take up to 9 hours to do. So if you saw the video of this, you noticed they had the face mask in a very specific location, and it was locked into this stand, and it was not going to move, and they had to move into the perfect position to actually get it to work. So, you know, unless you are being hunted down by a super spy agency of a foreign government, you're probably not going to have to worry about this. And if you're still worried about it, then just simply use a passcode. I mean, that's the recommendation from Apple. So we had that Face ID spoof out there. Then we had the kid and his mom. There was a mom who showed how her 10-year-old son was able to pick up her phone and access her phone with Face ID. And this one did show that he didn't have to use the passcode. There wasn't any confusion. It just naturally worked. And so what's going on here? Well, this kid, if you saw the video, he was almost a clone of his mom. It was really weird. It was actually kind of freaky. So he very much looked almost exactly like his mom. And I also need to point out that Apple has said in their own white paper, quote, the statistical probability for unlocking Face ID, and I'm paraphrasing that part there, or unlocking with Face ID, is different for twins and siblings that look alike, and I guess almost also I'll add in their family members that look alike, and also among children under the age of 13, and that is because their distinct facial features have not fully developed. So anytime we see these tests with Face ID and you see kids under the age of 13, Apple's already saying Face ID is not going to be able to statistically work as well with children under the age of 13. So, you know, I think that's being factored into this mom and her kid being able to unlock her phone. Now, of course, parents seem particularly worried about this because they're like, well, if my kid can get into my phone using my Face ID, that's a huge problem, right? They're gonna get in and see things that they shouldn't see. And, you know, I'm having a little bit of trouble with this one. If you have a child that really can't be trusted, then you're probably going to have to use a passcode, right? I mean, for example, my kids know my passcode for my phone. In case there's an emergency, I want them to be able to get in there. But we've had a discussion with them, and they've been told they're not allowed to go into my phone without their permission. And guess what? My kids don't. And I'm not saying I'm a perfect parent here, but you talk to your kids, you do these things, and there would be serious consequences if they did try to get my phone. And I get that every family situation is different. Everybody's kids are different. But I think parents, we're pretty smart. We know what our kids are like. We know how they are. So if you have a kid that's precocious and is just going to try and get into your phone, unfortunately for you, you're probably not going to be able to use Face ID. Or you're going to have to try it and make sure that it works and your kid can't get in using Face ID, especially if they look like you. And if they can, you're going to have to fall back and use a passcode. And Apple's already kind of warned about that. The other thing we need to talk about is what I'm calling the passcode hack or the passcode bypass. And I know we already discussed this on the last episode of the MacCast. And what I'm talking about is the fact that the Face ID system Apple has put together is a learning system. It uses artificial intelligence, it uses machine learning to learn about your face and changes that might happen with your face over time. So when you have two people that look alike and one of them tries to use Face ID and the Face ID fails, if that person then enters in the passcode, what happens is the system can actually learn that person's face and add it to its machine learning. So what happens is every time you fail a Face ID scan, so it could be you, it could be someone else, when you hold up the Face ID, it does the scan, it checks against the scans that it already has stored, or really it's the facial map, the depth map, and then it creates a statistical probability factor, a number that it checks, and if it's above a certain threshold, then Face ID unlocks the phone and gets you in. If it's below that threshold, it then looks at, well, how far below that threshold is it? Is it close? Do I think this is probably you, but just not with enough certainty to let you in the phone? If that number is within that threshold, and then you enter the passcode, what happens is the Face ID system assumes it's you, because guess what? You knew the passcode and you almost look like you. And then what it'll do is it'll temporarily add that face scan, that quote unquote failed face scan data, to its knowledge base, into its learning algorithm. And then from that point forward, for a short period of time, it will accept scans that are similar to that one that was the failed scan that you then verified with your passcode. And so that makes sense. That's the learning part of the algorithm. Now, if your face remains the same as that sort of failed scan, it assumes, hey, something about your face has changed. Maybe you had a scar, or maybe you grew a beard, or maybe you put on a lot of makeup that day. And it will adopt that new norm. If it doesn't, it will only work for a short period of time, and then it will discard that data and go back to its original data. So this is how it can deal with your face changing over time, or even dramatically. So say you have a full beard, and then you shave it off. This already came up in the news this week, where somebody did that and suddenly Face ID couldn't recognize him anymore. Well, what would happen is Face ID wouldn't recognize him for that first scan because you had a beard and now suddenly you don't. The minute you enter that passcode, though, it's going to add that new scan data and go, oh, okay, this is you without a beard, and I can recognize you as you grow that beard back slowly over time. So the entire thing is a learning system, and yeah, there's going to be ways to spoof it, and you can definitely spoof it if you're adding, you know, other people's face data mixed in with your data, and they look like you within a reasonable degree. But outside of that, it's a pretty darn secure system, and there's a lot of security experts and people saying that Apple has built one of the best facial recognition security systems out there. Is it 100% foolproof in every scenario? Absolutely not, but neither was Touch ID, and actually Face ID statistically is much better. So just want to clear that up, because I know that's been floating around in the news a lot over the past week, and I'm sure we're going to get more of these reports. And a lot of times it's clickbait, linkbait, sensational headlines. And I want to make sure that you have all of the information to know what's going on there, and you can use that to share with your friends and family. So another little bit of, and I'm not going to call this FUD because I don't think this is FUD, but a little bit of confusion that came out this week was over Animoji, the Animoji feature on the iPhone, and the use of the True Depth camera system. There was a report out that if you covered up all of the sensors in the True Depth camera, except for the camera module itself, the RGB camera module, Animoji would still work. And the implication was that, hey, you don't need an iPhone 10 to do Animoji, so why is Apple reserving this feature only for iPhone 10 users? This could be available on the iPhone 8, the 8 Plus. This could be available on an iPhone 7. Well, Apple must be using Animoji just to make us pay more for an iPhone when we really don't need to do that. And I have to admit, even I was fooled by this report, because when I tested this on my iPhone 10, absolutely it worked. I took some tape, I covered up all of the sensors except the camera, I fired up Animoji, and sure enough, Animoji worked. It could track my face. It actually did a fairly decent job, but I did notice it wasn't quite working 100%. It was a little bit off. So why does it work, and why does Apple say you need a True Depth camera system to actually use Animoji? And the reason it works is because with Animoji, the True Depth camera system just captures a crude depth map of your face using the IR system. It does it very quickly. It's not the same as it would capture, say, for using the face scan for Face ID. It just does a really quick one. And then once it captures that, what it does is it then just uses only the RGB camera to actually track and match your facial movements and expressions to the Animoji. So it's doing that map real quick, and then from that point forward, it's the RGB camera doing all of the lifting in terms of tracking your facial movements and expression. And I shouldn't say just the RGB camera, because it's also using the neural engine part of the A11 Bionic chip that's in your iPhone to actually process all that data. So there's a lot of data processing that goes on here. And of course, other phones don't have that same chip. Well, the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus do, but they lack the True Depth camera system. So all of those things come together to make Animoji work. So yes, technically, you can get Animoji to work without the IR camera and the true depth camera system stuff, but it does not work nearly as well, and it breaks down pretty quickly. And the fact that it would work is proven out by looking at some of the third-party applications that are out there that do similar tracking, face tracking and facial gesture and movement tracking on older iPhones. Another great example to look at is Snapchat. Snapchat has these face mask filters where you can look like you have a mask on your face, and those have worked long before the iPhone 10 came out. But if you use that same feature in Snapchat on an iPhone 10, it does the tracking much better. It looks much more realistic than it does, say, on an iPhone 7 Plus. So yes, Apple probably could have made the Animoji feature available on other phones outside the iPhone 10, but it seems like they made a call that they wanted the feature to work at a certain quality level, and they weren't really willing to compromise and have less of an experience than you get on the iPhone 10. That might upset some people out there, and it just happens to be something that Apple does. They make a call on certain technologies and say, this is how it has to work, this is the minimum specs. And I doubt they're doing it just to try and sell more iPhone 10s. I think they really care about the quality of the experience. Is it a side benefit that they might sell more iPhone 10s because of that? Absolutely. And I'm sure they factored that into their decision as well. But I don't think that's the only reason they held back Animoji from older phones. And so, again, just want to clear up some information that's been floating around in the press this week. Real quick one here. If you have been running iOS 11, iOS 11.2 has been released. It has a couple of key fixes. One of the big ones to know about, especially as we move here into winter, is if you're in a cold environment, you may have noticed an issue with the iPhone 10 screen when you move from extreme cold to extreme heat. So anytime there was rapid changes in temperature, there was a potential problem where the screen would become unresponsive, and iOS 11.2 does fix that issue. iOS 11.2 also addressed an issue that could cause distortion in live photos or videos captured with an iPhone 10. So you can grab the latest update to iOS through the standard software update in settings. That is out and available now. A little bit of bad news if you were hoping to have a HomePod under the Christmas tree this holiday season. Apple made a statement to TechCrunch saying that they, quote, need a little more time before the HomePod is ready for their customers. Apple didn't share any specific details about why the HomePod was delayed. I wouldn't really expect them to. But I would say it's not too surprising, because we had been hearing that the supply chain buildup was going pretty slowly, and that a lot of reports were saying Apple was going to only have about 50,000 units ready to ship in December or even before the end of the year. And there have been predictions that Apple is going to ship just 4 million units of the HomePod next year. So they are delaying the HomePod into sometime in 2018. They gave a shipping window of early 2018 in the US, UK, and Australia. It's important to note that early for Apple is usually a pretty big window. When they say early 2018, that could mean any time between January and June. Although I think they're probably going to have it out, I would guess, toward the end of the first physical quarter of 2018. So January, maybe around March, the March-April timeframe. It could be sooner. We could see it in January. Who knows? But Apple really isn't saying at this point. For those of you who don't know, the HomePod is Apple's $349 speaker with a Siri digital assistant built-in wireless speaker. They showed it off at the Worldwide Developer Conference this year and had said it was going to be out in December. They even had demos at the Worldwide Developer Conference, but they were not hands-on. So we knew things were pretty tentative at that point. They weren't really letting any of the reviewers touch the HomePod, although Apple has said the big focus of the HomePod was on the audio quality, and many of the people who had a chance to hear it said it sounded great. It certainly should, because it features 7 tweeters, a central up-firing subwoofer, and 6 microphones that form a beam-forming array. That's for the Siri voice assistant part. So some pretty cool technology in there. It also features AirPlay 2 technology. It's an AirPlay 2 speaker, and what that means is that AirPlay 2 speakers are going to be able to have iOS devices stream music simultaneously to multiple speakers at the same time, something you currently can't do with iOS. You can do, I think, in iTunes on the Mac, but never been able to be able to do that from an iOS device. And it's not clear, because of the HomePod delay, if that means AirPlay 2 speakers are also going to be delayed. Apple wasn't going to be the only one able to make AirPlay 2 speakers with the HomePod. Third parties also had access to be able to make AirPlay 2 speakers. So we don't know if AirPlay 2 is delayed along with the HomePod. Apple hasn't really said anything about that, but I would imagine that may be the case. And of course, all of this a little bit of a bummer if you were hoping to have a HomePod for the holidays. I'm sure Apple's not too happy about missing the holiday season for HomePod shipments as well. It's going to hit their bottom line just a little bit. So point is, you know, I think I'd rather see the HomePod delayed than have it in limited supply, or worse, end up with unfinished features or hardware bugs or issues. I think that causes a bigger problem for Apple. So I think, you know, getting it right and getting it right the first time is really important. With respect to the HomePod, we're already getting rumors about future features for the HomePod, features that might not show up until 2019. There's at least one analyst out there saying that Apple is planning on incorporating facial recognition and image recognition into a future version of the HomePod, probably slated for release in 2019. And, you know, it's funny with some of these rumors. I think these are easy predictions to make, especially when you're speculating that far out. Yeah, Apple is into facial recognition. They're into image recognition right now. And the fact that they might want to build this into future products, I think, is no stretch of the imagination. So I think it's obvious, but hey, the rumor's out there, so I thought I'd let you know about it. And then finally in the news for this week, iMac Pro is, as far as we know, still supposed to come out sometime in December. That thing is a screaming awesome beast, and it may be even more awesome because developers Jonathan Levin and Steve Trotton Smith, they've been digging around into Apple's latest release of Bridge OS. And I tried to get more information for you on Bridge OS and exactly what it is. They were looking at Bridge OS 2.0, something they got through Apple's developer program. And it does seem to be a special version of an operating system that's designed to run on Apple's A10 Fusion coprocessor. And it looks like it's something specific to the new iMac Pro. So they were digging around in there, and what they found was that the iMac Pro is probably going to have an A10 Fusion coprocessor built into it to run this little operating system. And Steve Trotton Smith thinks that it's there so that Apple can experiment with tighter controls of the Mac OS operating system without upsetting developers. He also mentions that it does appear to be handling things like the Mac boot process, which is pretty cool. And also security and the FaceTime camera. So Apple kind of offloading some of the lower level controls and stuff to a A10 Fusion coprocessor that's looking like it's going to be in the iMac Pro. And one of our favorite leaked developers, Guillerme Rambo, also was poking around in there, and he found a setup animation for Hey Siri on the Mac. So it also seems like this A10 Fusion processor on the iMac Pro is going to enable Hey Siri functionality. So you'll be able to say that to your iMac Pro and activate Siri without having to touch anything. And he did note that the setup process animation was implemented with the regular app kit, not a port of, say, UIKit from iOS or UXKit. So it does seem to be something that's native to the Mac. He also noted that it does seem to have support for multiple users, which is something you would definitely want for a Mac version. Not multiple users in terms of being logged into one user account, it would recognize two different people, but if you have multiple user accounts set up on a Mac, you can set up Siri for each user under each user account. So pretty excited about the iMac Pro. I am curious to see where the pricing lands on that, and we're going to be talking about the iMac Pro versus the iMac here in a little bit in the in your feedback section of the MacCast. But before we get to that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that sponsor is Squarespace. Hey, look, if you need a website and you want something that is quick, that is easy, and it's going to look awesome both on desktop and in on mobile, then you want to go to Squarespace. They give you everything you need to get a website up and running, all from a single source. It's one of the reasons I really love Squarespace. They give you the domain, the hosting, professional responsive designs and templates, access to all of the good stuff that you might need, like e-commerce, social media integration, analytics, and a whole lot more. And they make it super quick and fast to get up and running. They have it all on one platform, and they have some of the best customer service in the business. I've used Squarespace many times to set up quick websites to promote events and meetups for the MacCast. We used it for our Disney meetup. And look, I'm a web developer. I could build all that stuff myself pretty quickly and easily, but I really wanted something that looked great, was easy to set up, and Squarespace was perfect for that. They have all kinds of templates for any kind of website that you might need, whether you need a portfolio website because you're an artist, a designer, or photographer. It's great for that. You want to get your work, you want to show it off and make it look amazing. They can do that for you. If you're a writer or a blogger, great for that. Maybe you have a wedding coming up and you want to set up a website so that your guests can see what's going on and keep up to date with all of the latest and happenings as you lead up to the event. And then maybe you want to post photos and stuff from the event so that you can share that stuff. You can do all of that with Squarespace, or you have an event, or maybe you have a sports team or a club that you're running. It's perfect for that sort of thing because you can set up calendars and schedules and everything, and they make it quick and easy. They have drag and drop tools. And if you want to get in deeper and go all the way down into the code level, they let you do that as well. They give you the ability to design, customize, and adapt everything quickly and easily to meet your needs. And it is totally awesome. You're going to love it. They even have blocks that you can add in for things like maps and galleries, like I said, social media integration, audio if you want to do a podcast, and even more. So if you want to check out Squarespace, here's the deal. You can go to squarespace.com and get a free trial. You can try it out completely free. And when you're ready to launch your website, you can use the offer code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. So that's squarespace.com to get your free trial. Do it today. Check it out. I think you're really going to love it. And a big thank you to Squarespace for their support of the MacCast. So one of the things that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast is I had a listener who had said he had some trouble updating from his current iPhone to an iPhone X using an encrypted backup inside iTunes. No matter what he did, he couldn't get the upgrade to happen. And I was a little bit confused about that. I had mentioned that I personally had used the new auto setup, which allows you to basically put your new iPhone X next to your old iPhone and then automatically transfers everything over. It is an awesome setup process. If you do iCloud backup, it handles everything for you. It's quick and seamless and easy, and you don't even have to do the iTunes backup thing. But if you prefer to do the iTunes backup, and I think it's always a good idea anyway, I still pull the backup of my old device just in case. Then maybe you want to restore from that, and you should be able to restore from that. And I thought it a little bit odd, and I asked for some of your feedback, and I got this response from Steven.
Hi, Adam. My name is Steven. I sent you an email about this, but I thought I'd leave a message. I heard the most recent MacCast about the iPhone 10, and in terms of doing the quick conversion from an old phone versus the connection to a computer and doing a hard backup. I did a hard backup, and it was an interesting experience. When I first did it, it wouldn't go through, and thought about it, and what I realized was the backup that I had from my old phone on the computer was the most up-to-date version of iOS 11 versus the phone, which came with iOS 11.0, so it wouldn't accept it. So I went in, I did the update on the new phone, and then it went through flawlessly. Just some general reactions to the phone. I'm really happy with it. I love the gesture versus the home button. To me, just the way you use the phone is very, very easy to me. It seems much easier than the home button. I've had no problem adjusting. The phone is lightning fast. Almost at times I get dizzy because it moves so fast. I think the only criticism I have, and it's not really a criticism, is that coming from a 6 Plus, it really is a smaller screen. It's a longer screen, but it's not as wide a screen. I'm probably a person who will look at the phones next year and see if they do a version based off the Plus version phone that has a bigger screen, because I enjoy that. Although, I will say holding this phone is a heck of a lot easier than my 6 Plus. So there's always a trade-off and a compromise. But overall, I would say, as a person who stood outside for 7 hours at an Apple store, I think it's a terrific phone. I'm really happy overall with what Apple's done. Again, keep in mind, I'm coming from the 6 Plus. Keep in mind the chip is much better. Siri is much better. The technology is much more advanced, as I'm sure it would be on the 8 and 8 Plus for me with some of the features. But I really wanted the new technology, and I don't regret getting it. Anyway, thanks, Adam. I enjoy the program. Just wanted to give you my point of view on the iPhone 10.
Hey, thanks, Stephen. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on that, and also pointing out what had happened with the upgrade from a backup, a local backup in iTunes. And a number of you actually pointed that little issue out to me, and I don't know why I didn't think about that, but that makes complete sense. The iPhone 10 did ship with iOS, I think, 11.0.2. So if you had a newer version on your phone and that was your backup, then you, of course, had to bring the iPhone 10 into the same level in order to restore the backup. So just throwing that out there for anyone else who might run into that problem. I fully expect that Apple will be updating its image files on future versions of the iPhone 10, so who knows if you'll run into that problem or not. But I totally agree with you also that the iPhone 10 is kind of amazing. We already talked about the screen a little bit and the differences there, and I totally get that if you're coming from a Plus, it does feel like a smaller screen, even though, like, information-wise, you get more information on the iPhone 10. There's actually more information on the screen, even though it's a little bit narrower, because the pixel resolution is actually higher. But everything is physically smaller, so I do totally understand that. And of course, we already know Ming-Chin Kuo says, yeah, we are going to have a Plus version of the iPhone 10 this year. So that's probably good news for you, Stephen. But thank you for your feedback. And of course, I did ask you for some feedback, and Stephen wasn't the only one to chime in. I actually also received this message from Mike.
Hey, Adam, this is Mike from Hershey, Pennsylvania. I love the podcast. Just wanted to give you a few thoughts on the new iPhone 10. I've had it since the 3rd. Overall, I really like it. The swiping up with the Face ID is working a lot better than I had thought it would. So overall, I'm enjoying the phone. I guess I'm going to give you my three nitpicky issues with the phone that I wish they would fix or change. The first is, I do like having the battery percentage on the phone itself and not having to swipe down to the control center panel. So I wish that they would take out the little battery icon and allow you to just have a percentage up in the corner. I really don't need to see the graph of the battery. I'd rather have the percentage. Again, nitpicky, but I do like having the battery percentage on the screen. Another thing, I'm still getting used to Apple Pay with having to double tap and then have the Face ID activate. It just seemed a lot smoother with Touch ID that I could just put my thumb down and it pretty much went through smoothly. I'm not having problems doing Apple Pay. It's just having to do the double tap and then having the Face ID activate. Still getting used to that. And I guess my biggest nitpick, if you will, is I'm still not enamored with the app switcher. I enjoyed just on Touch ID, just, you know, double tapping, pulling everything up, and being able to flick your apps away. Now having to kind of go halfway up the screen to get it to activate, and then having to press on an app to get the minus signs to come up. I remember in older versions of iOS, they had the minus signs. But to have to do that to get rid of some of your apps seems to be a step back to me. I'm not sure why they couldn't have just still allowed you to flick the apps off of the screen once you activated the app switcher. And so it's taking a little longer to go between apps when I have multiple apps open and I'm trying to go back and forth between apps, where it was much easier on Touch ID. So those are my three. Again, I will admit nitpicky because overall I do like the phone and I'm enjoying it so far. But the battery percentage, the Apple Pay, and then the big one for me is the app switcher that I wish they would allow you to still flick up to get rid of the apps. And I don't know if they're going to be able to do something maybe in future versions where you don't have to go halfway up the screen to try to catch it and activate it. So overall, those are my quick thoughts. Again, still enjoy the phone. Love the podcast. Keep up the great work. Take care.
Hey, thank you, Mike. I appreciate the feedback there and letting us know your opinion. I'm going to just comment on a couple things here. And again, some of these things are my opinion and some of these things hopefully will maybe help you out a little bit. As far as the battery percentage thing goes, I totally get that there's people who like to pay attention and watch that percentage throughout the day and make sure that they're not running too low. I actually was in that camp for a long, long time. I have to tell you, personally, best thing I ever did for myself was actually turn off the battery percentage so I would stop obsessing over it. I would get freaked out when I would see my battery at certain times of the day get to certain percentages. I kind of had this thought in my mind that, oh my gosh, I need to plug in right now. You know, it's going to get really, really bad. And by turning the percentage off, what I discovered was that, you know, the iPhone makes it through a day, especially the iPhone X. I had it off the charger. I noticed the other day I was in the red. Of course, I didn't know what percentage it was. This was on Friday, I think it was. And I had not plugged it in the night before. And when I went to look, this was about the end of the day. The second day, it was almost 5 p.m., and I was still at 15%. And it was actually pretty darn good, considering I had gone through basically 2 days, almost 48 hours, and not gone to the point where it was even going to go into low power mode. So I thought that was pretty amazing, and I really don't obsess over it. But that's just me. I get that maybe you want the percentage. It would be nice if Apple gave you the option to either have the battery indicator or the percentage. I kind of agree with that. We should have the choice. But for me, I think turning off the battery percentage is the way to go. I will 100% agree with you on Apple Pay. Apple Pay on the phone is clunkier than it was under Touch ID. You have to double tap the button and then it comes up and then you've got to give the phone your attention and then Apple Pay is active and then you can kind of pay. Definitely not as smooth as just putting your finger on the fingerprint sensor. For me, that's why I'm glad I have the Apple Watch. I actually use my Apple Watch for Apple Pay much more frequently than my phone, but it would be nice if it was a little bit smoother process. And then just a comment, because I'm one of these app quitter people as well, and I get that you want to do it to kind of organize or have fewer apps to swipe through when you're in the app switcher. But I do have to point out, and I know this to be a fact, it's been pointed out by many, many people in the community, there really is almost no reason to quit the apps that are in the background, that are in the app switcher. The really only legitimate reason to have to shut those down is if an app is locked up or misbehaving. And so I have to wonder if Apple didn't make that UI change in the iPhone X, not just because of the gesture part of it, but because you really don't need to be shutting down your apps all that often. And I'll also mention that if you do the tap and hold thing to bring up the little minus signs, once the minus signs are on the apps, you can still flick up to close them. Once they're in that mode, you don't have to hit the little red minus symbol. I know it's still a two-step process. It's still slower than just opening up the app switcher and swiping up, but I just wanted to point that out. But really, you shouldn't have to worry about it, you know? And when you're using the apps, your most recently used apps should be in the front section. You know, they get reorganized, so you shouldn't have to swipe too far through the current apps that you're using, even if you have a lot of apps open. They'll kind of fall to the background. But they're not really using any more battery. They're not using any more RAM. And it's even been pointed out that you'll reduce your battery life if you close apps like that, because it takes them longer to open up. They have to kind of open from scratch, as opposed to having some stuff already saved in memory. And it manages the memory. So when I say saved in memory, if you get to the point where you do run out of memory, it will just drop those apps off naturally. So really, outside of OCD, which I'm OCD about my apps, and I've always wanted to close them. I'm trying to break the habit of it. You really don't need to be closing them down. So I really wouldn't worry about it too much. Just leave them open. Let them sit there. They're not doing any harm, and you'll actually get better performance if you leave them there. I know it's kind of a hard thing to do, but I just wanted to comment on that. I do want to bring up one thing about my iPhone X that's frustrating me, and I don't know if it's just the iPhone X, if it's iOS 11, and part of the reason I'm bringing this up is to throw it out to the community and ask if anybody else is having this problem. But ever since getting my iPhone X, if I am listening to a podcast or I am listening to music, especially in my car, I can unfortunately no longer use Hey Siri. And I don't know if it has to do with the fact that my iPhone X is hearing my the music coming out of my speakers in my car, and it's just getting confused. If the noise canceling is not working as well as it has in the past, but I can tell you it's completely driving me nuts, because I use Siri functionality, voice control functionality, when I'm in the car all the time, and now I actually have to reach up to my Bluetooth adapter, which I can press and hold on and do an extra action to be able to use Siri, or I can use my Apple Watch. Sometimes I'll do it that way, and that works okay. But I don't know why that feature doesn't work anymore. What has happened? And I'm curious if anybody else is experiencing that, and if maybe there's a fix or a workaround that I'm not aware of or missing. So I'm throwing that out to the community. And one other thing related to the new iPhone X, and this actually would impact the iPhone X, the iPhone 8, and the 8 Plus, anything that has Apple's new wireless charging or contactless charging feature built into it. I received a voicemail from Steve, and he is one of the people who uses a a magnetic mount for his iPhone. A lot of you have these. It's the mount where you put a little metal plate on the back of your iPhone, and then the mount has a magnet in it, and you just attach that to, say, your dashboard or wherever you might want to mount the thing. Well, of course, Steve noticed that if you put the mounting plate on the back of your iPhone, your iPhone 8, 8 Plus, or 10, anything with induction charging, it messes with that magnetic field, as you might expect. And guess what? Your contactless, your wireless charging will absolutely not work at all. So just be aware of that. He did discover that if you move the mounting plate to near the bottom of the phone or the top of the phone, because the induction coil is actually almost dead center in your iPhone, you can kind of work around it, but you may still have a little bit of interference. And he also did recommend a smaller mounting plate. If you can get a smaller mounting plate, he recommended one from a company called iOttie, I-O-T-T-I-E, that he particularly liked and thought was pretty good. That works a little bit better. So if you are using a magnetic mount in one of those plates, you are going to have to position it differently if you get a new iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, or iPhone 10, or just not go with that kind of mounting system altogether. So just be aware of that if you're upgrading and you're a fan of the magnetic mounts. But thanks to everybody who sent in feedback on the iPhone X. And if you still have some feedback, certainly send it along. I'm curious to hear your stories and experiences, tips and tricks, all those sorts of things. Shoot your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to talk about Siri search under iOS 11, or Spotlight search. I don't know what Apple calls it now. They're kind of combined, right? Siri has this intelligence system that does little search suggestions when you're in the search functionality on iOS. And George emailed me because he was a little bit frustrated by the new Siri search and suggestions. He uses the Siri search, as a lot of us do, myself included, mainly as an application launcher. I don't go in there and do too much searching. Usually what I'm trying to do when I pull down from the main screen to activate search is actually launch an app. I have so many apps, it's easier to just start typing the first few letters of the name of the app. It pops up and then you can tap on it and launch it. But what George discovered was that when he went in to disable some of the extra search kind of functionality or suggestion functionalities in his settings, that he could no longer launch his apps. He actually, they just wouldn't show up in the app launcher. And the reason is all this stuff is powered by iOS 11's new search suggestions feature. Actually, this may have come partially about in iOS 10. And it uses the artificial intelligence in the iOS operating system to kind of mine the data within your apps. You can search within the contents of your apps. It'll watch like your browsing history and some of the stuff that you do in news, all to try and make more intelligent search suggestions to you in the search area. And you can actually disable this feature by going into settings on your iPhone under Siri and search, and then turn off the suggestions and search. And George, you may want to play around with this. If you do that, the search will go back to more like the way it was under iOS 10, and you should be able to search for and launch your apps from there. But what I think specifically happened to you is when you went in and you started to try and disable some of these suggestion features, probably selectively, which is something that you can do, you can actually turn them off for individual applications. So if you go into settings, into Siri and search, and you scroll down, you'll notice you have a list of all of your applications, and you can tap on any one of those applications and you can turn off search and suggestions just for that app. And it's worth noting at this point, if you had gone into this area under iOS 10 and you had turned off some of the content searching options, that stuff is carried over into iOS 11 into this new way of doing things. So this ability to change the settings for search and suggestions by app is new in iOS 11. It would have carried over. The bad part about it is that if you turn off search and suggestions for an individual app in the settings here, what happens is the app itself will not come up in search when you start typing the first few letters of the app. So let's use Dropbox, for example. Say you went into the settings, Siri and search, and turned off search and suggestions for Dropbox. If you then are pulling down search and trying to launch Dropbox by typing D-R-O, it is not going to show up as an app that's available to launch. You can even type D-R-O-P-B-O, and it still won't show up until you type X. Once you've typed the full name, it will show up in the app launcher. And again, this is if you've turned off search and suggestions for that specific app. So in order to use search as an app launcher, you need to have search and suggestions turned on for every application that is in the Siri and search settings. And that's just the way it has to be. Unfortunately, that also means for you, George, that it's probably going to bring up other suggestions and things like that, some of that extra data that you were trying to get rid of. But unfortunately, you can't have it one way and not the other. Again, the only other way I know to do this is to actually turn off search and suggestions for everything, and then it does seem to work for any of your applications. It kind of goes back to the old way. So maybe that's the way you want to run it. I personally like having some of the extra search and suggestion features in there. It does a little bit more intelligent suggestions, including apps that I might launch different times during the day. So I have kind of some apps that I use at night versus during the day, and it is aware of that with those search suggestions turned on, and it does surface that stuff a little bit. So play around with it, see how it goes for you, but I think that's what's going on there for you, and hopefully some of these explanations and tips help some of the rest of you out there as well, at least when it comes to searching on iOS. And then finally, in the show for this week, I had a question from George, or actually George wanted me to talk about something. George has an 8-year-old iMac, and he says he's probably ready for an upgrade. Wow, George, I would say, yeah, you probably are. But he is wrestling with buying a new iMac that's currently out now, like a 27-inch 5K iMac, or waiting and buying the new iMac Pro. And so his question is specifically, do I buy a reasonably juiced up iMac, say in the $3,000-ish range, or do I buy a maxed out iMac 5K, maybe costing around $5,300, about the same price as a basic, or what we're expecting the price of a basic iMac Pro to be? I think Apple said they would be starting around $5,000. So the question is, you know, what should I buy? Should I buy now? Should I wait? And I think that's a great question, George. Now, we need to keep in mind, George has told me that he does use his Mac for video editing and for Final Cut, which, again, I'm just impressed, George, that you're still using an 8-year-old iMac. Now, he did mention he upgraded to an SSD and he has it maxed out on RAM, but still, 8 years out of a single Mac, that's... I'm happy when I can get 5 years out of a Mac, and that's usually how long I go between upgrades. So you are certainly, I think, definitely ready for an upgrade. And you allude in your email that you already kind of know the answer that I'm going to give you. And I have to say, you are probably correct. I'm having a hard time recommending that you hold out for an iMac Pro. And let me tell you why. You're running an 8-year-old iMac, and you're saying to me now, just now, that it's getting quote-unquote long in the tooth for you. And the current 27 5K iMac, starting at about $2,300, is going to be a massive upgrade for you. Even if, and I would definitely advise, because it sounds like you've already done some upgrades to your current 8-year-old iMac, that you upgrade to the 1 terabyte SSD. You probably go with 32 gigabytes of RAM. So that is going to bring your price up to about the $3,500 range. And you may even want to splurge and get the higher end quad core i7 4.2 gigahertz processor, which I think adds another $200. So you're looking at maybe $3,600 for that machine. And it's going to be a massive upgrade. And you're going to save, what is that, about $1,800, almost $2,000 that you get to keep in your pocket. I think that's a pretty good deal, and I think you're going to be really happy with the machine that you get. Now, I say that, but here's what Jeff says in return. This was all in his email. So he says, okay, here's my concern, says Jeff. I want a kick, and I'm going to edit this for the family-friendly podcast here, but I want a kick-butt, top-of-the-line desktop. And I would say, yeah, Jeff, you absolutely do, but I think if you get a souped-up 27-inch 5K iMac, you are going to definitely have that, and then some. But then Jeff says, but the space gray combo and the keyboard look really cool. And also, by the way, I hate the flat on its back white magic keyboard. All right, not much I can do there. If you want space gray, the iMac Pro is really your only option, or maybe spray paint. But no, don't spray paint. Don't spray paint your Macs. We don't want to do that. No, if you want to hold out for space gray and you want to pay an $1,800 premium for that, I don't think I can stop you. The other concern you said you have was, hey, the iMac 4-core limit, that might be a real drag in 2020. And what if I don't want to buy again so quickly? Well, considering the fact that you apparently go 8 years between buying computers, I think you win the argument here. Yeah, you probably should go with an iMac Pro if you want to go that long between buying new machines. And then Jeff also says, I know the iMac will render a lot better than my old Mac. Yep, I've already kind of pointed that out. But surely the Pro would be comparatively instantaneous. And I would say, yes, it absolutely would. But here's a thought. You're saving so much money. What if you just bought a second iMac to do your rendering with the cash that you saved? And bear with me here, because you might be going, well, why don't I just get the Mac Pro that renders way faster? If you had a whole second machine, you got a couple of benefits. One, you can render on another machine without any performance hit at all to the machine that you're working on. So it would enable you to keep working while you're rendering, and then it really doesn't matter how long it takes to render the stuff that you're writing out, right? Plus, you'd have a whole entire backup Mac. So if something went wrong with your main Mac, you could just simply switch over and not skip a beat. So just thinking, I'm assuming you maybe do the video editing for your business. It might be worthwhile to just have two Macs, two iMacs versus just one. You could get, you know, a 20-inch iMac or a lower-specced iMac 27-inch 5K and have two machines. I know it sounds crazy, but just something to possibly think about. And then another thing you asked about was, hey, I could add more memory with to a greater degree on the iMac Pro, well beyond the ceiling that the iMac 5K has. And you're absolutely right. It's double the amount. You can go up to 128 gigabytes versus 64 gigabytes max on the iMac 5K. But really, do you need 128 gigabytes of RAM? Of course, we all want that. Let's be realistic. But are you going to need 128 gigabytes? I think 64 is already maybe overkill and extreme. You could probably get away with 32, but hey, 64, max it out. That'd be awesome. So yeah, what should you do? I don't know. I don't really know what I can tell you to do. But okay, you know, all that said, if you have the freaking money to get an iMac Pro, if you have $5,500 to spend on a computer and you want to throw it into an iMac Pro, why the heck not? Absolutely, go for it, man. The basic specs of that thing are unbelievable. You got the 5K display, the 27 inches, you got the higher end P3 color gamut. You know, it's going to look amazing. You've got an 8-core CPU in the base model, 32 gigabytes of RAM in the base model, a 1 terabyte SSD in the base model. Yeah, so it's going to have everything you need. I'm guessing you're going to want more RAM, so you're going to be plunking down a bit more cash. I'm going to guess by the time you're out the door, knowing what it sounds like you want, you're going to be in the more like the 6K range. But yeah, it's got a Radeon Pro Vega 56 graphics processor. Is it 56? I might have typed that wrong. Anyway, it's got a Radeon Pro Vega. Just the GPU alone is going to scream performance for your video rendering stuff. And I don't know if this matters to you or not, but it does have the 10 gigabit Ethernet, which is the first and only Mac, I think, that offers 10 gigabit Ethernet. Maybe the Mac Pros offer that. I don't remember. And of course, space gray. It's the only way you can get the space gray color. And you said you really want that. So hey, seriously, who would not want an iMac Pro? And if you can afford it and you're planning on holding on to that thing for another 8 years, I say go for it. Get that machine, max it out in December. You know, hold on to your pennies for now if you can hold out just a little bit longer. And I have a feeling that you can, and totally go for it. That's going to be a screaming, amazing machine. I totally want one. I'm not going to buy one because I can't afford it, but hey, if you can, more power to you, and enjoy that new machine, Jeff. I say get it, go for it, and when you do, let us know how it is. Shoot us some feedback. Tell us how awesome it is and how awesome you are for having that machine, and I won't be jealous. Wink, wink. No, I'll totally be jealous. But anyway, with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Hey, if you can support the Patreon, if you want to help support the MacCast directly, if you enjoy this show, if you've enjoyed this episode, if you've enjoyed our other episodes, please check out the Patreon page, patreon.com/MacCast. If you can give a little bit of money each month, I would really, really appreciate that. Big thank you to my sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question for me, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can shoot me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, follow me on social media. Another great way to support the podcast. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. And if you can give us a review on iTunes, that would be greatly appreciated. But for now, that is going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.